Hello, and welcome to episode 149 of the Sea Control podcast hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm the senior producer for Sea Control, Chris Lee. And this week, join us for an interview with former Secretary of the Navy, John Dalton, and former First Lady of the Navy, Margaret Dalton. In this interview, we talk about their experiences in leading the Navy, from the modern naval fitness standard to acquisition reform. The two discuss their experiences, their triumphs, and their hurdles as leading figures in the Navy. This episode is part one of two of the entire interview. We'll get started with this enlightening interview after a message from our sponsors.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sea Control. I'm Travis Nix, the Vice President of SimSec, and on behalf of SimSec, I'm honored to be joined today by the former Secretary and First Lady of the Navy, John and Margaret Dalton. Secretary Dalton served as Secretary of the Navy from 1993 to 1998. In that time, Mrs. Dalton was instrumental in many quality of life improvements in our Navy, to include improvements in base housing. And has conducted many outreach efforts, even holding frequent visits to aircraft carriers for groups of congressional spouses. Secretary and Mrs. Dalton, thank you for joining us. So, starting off, Secretary Dalton, so the first question, sir, is for you. You served as Secretary of the Navy from 1993 to 1998. Do you mind sharing how you became the Secretary of the Navy and the backstory to that time?
Sure, I'd be glad to. The reason I think I was considered to be Secretary of the Navy was because I had prior military service and also prior service, as a government official. I was president of Ginnie Mae, the Government National Mortgage Association, in the Carter administration, luncheon in Dallas. And sat next to him and got acquainted with him and liked him and decided to work in his campaign and was actively involved in his campaign. And when he was elected, he appointed me to be president of Ginnie Mae. And that was my first government service, and I really enjoyed it. And did that for 2.5 years. And then when they formed the reelection committee, I was named treasurer of the Carter Mondale reelection committee. And I was a young man. I was 37 at the time. And I was 35 when I got the Ginnie Mae appointment, and 37 when I became national treasurer of the campaign. And we had young children, and when a seat became available on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, after having worked in the campaign for about 6 months, I decided to ask the chief of staff of the President Carter, Hamilton Jordan, to if I could have this seat at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. I would still work on the campaign, but I'd taken a pay cut to go into government and another pay cut to go on the campaign, and I had small children, and so I thought that would be a better way, better for me personally, and so I was able to work that out and do that. And after the election in 1980, when President Reagan was elected, I had another, when I was on the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, the term didn't end in with the administration. It actually went through June of 82. And so I stayed on, for a number of months. And then a headhunter approached me, and I took a job in San Antonio, Texas, and lived in San Antonio for 12 years in the savings and loan business, and then in the private equity business, and then back in the investment banking business where I had originally been when I was working for Goldman Sachs, when I met Jimmy Carter, Governor Carter. But how I became Secretary of the Navy was I was also active in the Clinton campaign, and I was active in the Democratic Leadership Council, which was the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party, and Governor Clinton was chairman of the DLC, or the Democratic Leadership Council, so I got to know him through that. And when he was elected, when he was announced his candidacy for president, I supported him and was active in his campaign. And when he was elected, because of my, what I had done in the campaign and the fact that I had served on active duty and been involved in the Carter administration, so I had government experience and actually, what happened was, Henry Cisneros was mayor of San Antonio, and he approached me about 2 weeks before the election and said, who would that worked in the campaign could serve adequately in the new administration. And so I went down and he said, would you please think about that and come see me and tell me, since Henry Cisneros was on the transition team, there were like 8 or 9 people that were on the transition committee before the election, and he was one of them, and he solicited my advice about people who could serve in the administration. And we talked a couple of weeks before the election, and he said, we're going to win. And, you know, thank you for these names of the people that are, that you think could serve well. But what about you? And I said, you know, Henry, this is not a good time for me personally, financially. And, the only way I would go back into government service is if there was something that I, the meaningful that I could do. And he said, well, I don't know what you mean by meaningful, but the cabinet is spoken for. Is there anything other than the cabinet that you think you, that you would be interested in? I said, yes, there is one job, the Secretary of the Navy. And he said, I think you'd be great at that. And he said, get me your resume. I'm going to go to Little Rock tomorrow, and I'm going to see Warren Christopher, who's the chairman of the transition committee, and I'll give him your resume. And, you know, that's how it happened.
That's a great story. So you started off your time in the Navy at the U.S. Naval Academy and then went to submarines. And then afterward went on to the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And our question is sort of, how did the Naval Academy help you in your professional career? How did and how did those early formative experiences in your career help you become the Secretary of the Navy and then perform as Secretary of the Navy?
Well, it's helped me a great deal. First of all, as a way of background, I had an uncle who was a Navy hero in World War II. And, you know, I was a young boy. I was born in 41. So I was, but the first naval officer I ever heard about was my Uncle Roy, who actually won the Navy Cross, the Silver Star, and 5 distinguished flying crosses. I mean, he was a genuine hero of World War II. And so my impression of the Navy was very positive from the get-go. And I wanted to go to the Naval Academy, you know, as a young man, particularly in high school. And so But I didn't get the appointment out of high school. That's really the only place I applied, and I was just sure that's where I was going to go, and I had good grades and been an officer in the student council and all that kind of thing, and an athlete, and so I thought I would get the appointment, but I didn't. And so I went to LSU for a year, and that was a great experience, and I was active in government politics, you know, elected to the Student Government Association and president of my pledge class and that kind of thing. And then I went to see the congressman here again, what we were talking about earlier, the personal aspect of seeing the decision maker is key. And I went to see Overton Brooks, who was our local congressman, and told him that he had not given me his principal appointment the previous year, but I'd gone to LSU and done well, and I hoped that he would give me the appointment this year. And, you know, I said, if you do, I will, you know, it's not something you would regret because I will do well there. And he gave me the appointment, and I went to the Naval Academy. And, you know, I didn't get off to a great start at the Naval Academy. The first time they published an unsat list, my name was on it. I went out for the crew team and got cut and so forth. But I made the varsity. I made the plebe team in soccer and lacrosse and enjoyed that. And, you know, early on was the first time they had the aptitude scores for our company. I was number one in our company. And in my youngster year or sophomore year, they took a group to the Air Force Academy. You know, at that time, everybody spent a weekend at the Army at West Point. But this was the first time anybody had ever gone to Air Force Academy, and I was in the group that was selected for that and was a group commander in the second class year and went on a foreign exchange cruise with the Royal Navy my first class year. All those experiences were very helpful to me, both in my active duty service and the training that we had and the leadership skills you learn and so forth, were helpful to me both in business and when I became Secretary of the Navy.
All right. So, just a couple questions about being Secretary of the Navy and Navy policy at the strategic and the secretary level. So over the last decade, rapid innovation technology has been at the forefront of discussion topics in the maritime security community, particularly in the U.S. Navy. And many specialized organizations, DIUX and the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, Deep Blue, et cetera, have been established and then disestablished by Navy leaders with the initial objective of speeding up innovation. The relatively slow speed of integrating innovative technology into the Navy has been heavily criticized inside and outside the Navy. You served as the secretary during the mass adoption of the World Wide Web, the personal computer, the cell phone, and other new technologies. How did you achieve the high speed of integration of new innovative technologies that occurred under your leadership in the 90s? And in your experience, what is the most effective way for a Navy leader to set up our institution to more rapidly integrate modern technology into things like personnel management, maintenance, and operations?
Well, when I was in office, we had some major challenges with respect to acquisition. And we thought that the system needed an overhaul, and so we adopted what was called acquisition reform. And Norris Slatkin was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Research, Development, and Acquisition, or RDA, and she was very good in that job. John Douglas came after her, and he also was very good. And the two major weapon systems that we had to deal with were the F/A-18 ENF Super Hornet. I mean, that was the biggest aviation challenge that we had, and that system was very successful in that it came in on time, on budget, and underweight, and that was unusual in that typically major new weapon systems cost more and were delayed, and you know, there were a number of alterations that were having to be done on them. And so I think the acquisition reform that we instilled was able to project and to perform, and that system, I mean, you know, that weapon system was very successful. Similarly, on the other, another major weapon system was, first of all, to get the third Seawolf built, because it was a political issue. The previous administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, had been opposed to building the third Seawolf, and President and Governor Clinton in his campaign and President Clinton, when he was elected, wanted to have it done. But it was a political football, and I thought that we needed to build it for the industrial base. I mean, we needed to have that submarine built so that Electric Boat in New London and also the submarines that were built in Newport News would not lose all their people if we went 2 or 3 years without building a submarine. And we were able to prevail on that issue. And you might recall, going back politically, Clinton was elected in 92, and in 94, it was a big sweep from the standpoint of the Republican Party winning most of the seats.
Yeah, Conrad of America period, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I asked some of my friends on the Hill about the possibility of getting the Seawolf, the third Seawolf built. And they, you know, Phil Graham and others who that I knew from Texas and other states said, you can forget it. I mean, you know, you're not going to be able to pull that off. Well, I thought it was so important that we dedicated a lot of resources to get that third Seawolf built, and we were successful, and we ended up getting, you know, 75 votes in the Senate for it. That's not the exact number, but anyway, it wasn't close because we really worked it hard, and it was important. And then once we got that done, the next big thing was the new attack submarine, which is the Virginia class submarine, and that too was an important victory for the Navy Department. And similarly, you know, we moved forward with the V-22 in the Marine Corps, and that was a big weapon system that was, you know, controversial and had some early failures in terms of people being killed and, you know, testing it and so forth. And those were big weapon systems that were all important and all needed some leadership to get done, and we were able to get that done. in terms of, you know, the internet and the other things that you mentioned, that was all late in my term. I can remember having a tutor come in to help me, you know, help me learn how to use a computer. And, you know, he'd come in once a week. And, I mean, you know, I was a novice and, you know, I was, and still am in many ways. But at any rate, some of the technology that you mentioned was late in my administration.
Did it strike you as a priority to integrate computers and the internet into?
Yeah, I mean, I knew there were some people that were using email, but I remember sending my first email to Richard Danzig, who was more savvy than I was with the new technology, and I said something about something that I sent him, and he sent me an email back and said, "Welcome to cyberspace."
That's pretty good.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He was a great undersecretary and also an outstanding successor.
The two of you worked together, you and Secretary Danzig, to create programs like NavFit 98, the eval and fitness report system that we still use today. And a series of programs that were created in the late 90s or the mid to late 90s and then were used for over a decade or in some cases decades afterwards. I'm just curious, from a personnel standpoint, did it seem like it would be important to inject the internet and computers and software into personnel management and into communications?
Absolutely. I think those tools that you mentioned were very important. And, you know, I think that what we emphasized most in the 5.5 years I was there was people and the importance of treating people with dignity and respect. I mean, emphasizing our core values of honor, courage, and commitment. I mean, I don't know if you recall, but when I came in office, we had some significant issues with respect to dealing with people. We had the Tailhook Convention, and the discipline of all that was on my plate. We had the cheating scandal at the Naval Academy. We had the change in the culture of the Navy from the standpoint of gays in the military and women in combat. And both those things happened within 6 months of each other, and which was a big culture shock to the Navy. When I assumed office, I hadn't been there 2 weeks before there was a major headline in the Navy Times, which read, "Navy morale at all-time low."
Wow.
I mean, it was like banner headlines for, like World War III breaking out. And so I had a leadership challenge on my hand, and I think we answered the bell with respect to that. But personnel and evaluation reform, I mean, evaluation forms and doing all of that properly and using the technology that we helped develop, was very important to evaluating people and making sure that everybody got a fair shake.
What was it like dealing with those kinds of situations when they would come in? The Tailhook, I guess Tailhook was very early on.
Well, Tailhook was the biggest, it was the thing I spent more time on probably early on in my tenure than anything else. And it was, some have referred to it as the biggest blow the Navy has taken since Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was on the front page three days out of seven. some kind of story dealing with Tailhook for, you know, for a long period of time. And so you can see how people would be concerned about morale and when you're reading negative stories about your organization all the time on the front page of the newspaper. So
it also happened before he got there.
Yeah, it happened 2 years before I got there, but the discipline of it was my responsibility. And so,
I'm just wondering, we're going through the, what they're calling the Fat Leonard scandal right now. And, it sort of has bell ringing of the Tailhook time, particularly because of the impact it's having on promotion and on maybe on a,
you know, it's a very similar problem. And
how did you maintain morale in the Navy, at all levels in the Pentagon and in the fleet?
Well,
in that time or recover it?
I made a big point of accountability and responsibility. I let it be known that everyone in position of authority was going to be held accountable, and they were going to be, you know, if they were in charge with a duty with respect to people, they had to carry those responsibilities. And accountability and responsibility, treating every individual with dignity and respect, and living by our core values of honor, courage, and commitment were key. And, you know, if people didn't measure up, they weren't going to be promoted. And, you know, it was, I took a tough stand on that.
He also made it a point to visit as many ships and bases as he could and to let them know that not only did he expect that from them, but he also let them know that he cared about them and that he cared about the Navy and about what they were doing and what they were contributing. He did a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. And I really do feel like, when I left, 5.5 years later, I felt like the Navy was stronger. The morale was better. You know, the other problem we had was, because of the drawdown, the Cold War had ended, you know, a couple of years before I got there. And the drawdown, you know, people talked about the peace dividend. How are we going to, with this new peace, how are we going to draw down from the military and spend this money on other things? Well, as a result, promotion rates were much lower than normal. And I can remember a year after I assumed, or less than a year after I assumed office, we went to the 50th anniversary of D-Day in England. And President Clinton came aboard a ship, an aircraft carrier, to talk to all the sailors. And I saw David Gergen before the president got there. He got on board earlier, and he was a principal advisor to President Clinton, and he came up to me and he said, "What should the president know about the status of the morale of sailors?" And I said, "We've got a problem." And I said, "The problem is promotion rates are really behind where they should be. But the good news is promotion rates this year are going to be higher than last year. And next year, they're going to be higher than this year. And within 3 years, we're going to be back like we have always been with respect to promotion rates." And he said, "I want you to tell the president that when he gets here." And so, you know, the president already had his remarks planned for what he was going to say. But David Gergen called him over, and the three of us visited for a minute, and I told him the same thing. "Mr. President, these are the facts. You know, because of the drawdown, promotion rates have really been slow. And as a result, morale is low. But the good news is, and so President Clinton, without a note, gets up and goes through his spiel and he says, "But before I leave you today, I want you to know this. I know you're concerned about your advancement rates and your level of promotions, but let me tell you, young men and women, your promotion rates this year are going to be better than they were last year. And next year, they're going to be better than this year. And within 3 years, you're going to be right back like you have always been." And boy, the troops just rallied to the, you know, I mean, he was as good a politician. I mean, he just heard what I said before he walked on out on the platform and made it, brought it to life. And,
That was in France, not when we were in London, right?
It was on a carrier in just off Normandy.
Yeah, I mean, so it was not England.
Well, we went to London.
Yeah.
But this was on an aircraft carrier. And,
it's so fascinating to hear the backstory behind situations like that, isn't it?
Amazing.
Well, he really was, and you know, he came into office, as the, I'm sure he didn't get 20% of the vote from the armed forces personnel, but he earned the trust of the leadership and ultimately the rank and file. Because he was able to do stuff like that. I mean, he was a good commander in chief, mm-hmm. even though the typical armed service personnel didn't think he was going to be. But I think he genuinely earned their trust and was a fine commander in chief.
You spoke some about the drawdown and the reduction in funding, the peace dividend, and the subsequent just dramatic drop in budgeting for the Department of Defense and the Department of the Navy. So, you know, much has been made in recent months in particular about the strain of life while deployed at sea and how that conversation has been driven by the collisions of the USS John McCain and the USS Fitzgerald recently. The Center Armed Services Committee was very interested in 100-hour work weeks for sailors, sleepiness, and the short maintenance and training timelines. And some of that has been attributed to the artifacts and the remnants of the peace dividend time period. I'm just curious how you see the budgeting from the 1990s having played out over the last 20 years. The predictions that you and Undersecretary Danzig and the three CNOs you had made how those predictions have manifested over time. Gerald collisions made much about 100-hour work weeks for sailors and sleepiness prevailing in the fleet. I'm just curious how you see the drawdown of budgeting in the 90s having ramifications over the following decades. Just the predictions that you and Undersecretary Danzig and the CNOs that worked for you made about what would happen if we followed the peace dividend, and how that's played out.
Well, I think that it is the civilian leadership's responsibility to make sure that the military has adequate resources, and you know. We went through the quadrennial defense review every 4 years and reviewed what the needs were. And, it was our job then to articulate those needs to, the Congress and to the public and to generate the necessary resources. And I think we did well at that. I mean, I think, you always want more than you can get, but I think we did well from the standpoint of generating the resources. And then the other thing you talked about was training. And I think that is more the leadership of the military, responsibility. We don't get, the civilian leadership doesn't get involved in the actual training of people and dealing with the, amount of sleep and that kind of thing that you talked about. But I tried to always emphasize the importance of our people. And that means, quality of life issues. And Margaret was very helpful with respect to those issues. And I can tell you some stories and she'll talk to you about that as well. But, we made quality of life a priority and Margaret deserves a lot of credit for the things she did with respect to that. And treating our, you know, each individual with dignity and respect and making sure they were properly trained. I know that I had at that time we had 6 month deployments. There was a hard stop. And the CNO had to come see me if a ship was going to be longer than 6 months, being deployed 6 months. And it didn't happen very often because he didn't want to come talk to me about a six month deployment being longer than that. And so, it rarely happened in the 5.5 years I was there. And that sort of set the tone that, you know, the Secretary of the Navy was interested enough in the quality of life of the sailor and Marine that was a stipulation that the CNO had to get it cleared from me if there was going to be a deployment longer than 6 months. And that sort of, mindset permeated, I think, the Navy Department.
As recently as 2011, I know that there was one aircraft carrier that went on deployment for 11 months and then turned around and went back to sea very shortly thereafter for several months at a time. That's just incredible to hear.
Well, I tell you, you know, people start voting with their feet when that happens. I mean, today, I don't think we have a retention problem, but if you continue to do 11-month deployments and they become commonplace, I don't know the details of the incident that you're referring to of the 11-month deployment, but I know that's, you know, people have families and obligations and those kind of deployments that long really deteriorates the morale of sailors and Marines. So, and you know, they understand if there's an exception and they have to do something for the national security, and that's what they're there for. But by the same token, they have personal lives that require, you know, our looking out for them.
How were you able to strike that balance? It sounds like you made a decision that you would focus more on quality of life than operational tempo. And I'm just curious how that conversation played out with the admirals that are focused more on operational tempo.
Well, I think part of it was, you know, what I inherited with Tail Hook and the cheating scandal and the drawdown and so forth. And I wanted to emphasize people and, you know, if the Secretary of the Navy is talking about that kind of stuff, I mean, the admirals know that I select who goes where, you know, that in terms of who's going to be in what job. And, you know, if they flaunt the things that I'm for, it's not going to be in their interest. Mm-hmm. So I think the tone does get set at the top. Clearly you work with, the admirals and generals of the Navy and Marine Corps, and they know more about the operational aspects of it than I do. I mean, I had been out of the Navy. I left in 1969 and I became secretary in 1993. I mean, that's a good period of time to be away from the naval service. But, you know, I think I had the ability to assess the situation and make good decisions.
Hmm. Do you feel like that your time in business in those intervening years between 1969 and when you became Secretary of the Navy helped you make decisions quickly? And I'm just, we've been talking in the last year or so about the, particularly the administration's been talking a lot about the importance of having business practices interjected into government. And, you did have that experience. You had a long career in business and then came into government again. And I'm just curious how that played out.
Well, I think having a business background is useful. I mean, we've had many successful secretaries of the Navy and secretaries of other services who were not in business. But I think the practicality of meeting a payroll and assessing the bottom line and having things work well are useful. But I mean, similarly, there are high qualities and traits that come from being a lawyer or other occupations as well. So I think my business experience was helpful. I also think my prior government service was helpful. I also think that having served on active duty was helpful. I mean, there are plenty of fine secretaries who didn't do those things, but I think they were helpful to me.
Okay. So shifting gears just a little bit, one more question about the drawdown, the financial drawdown and the reduction in budgeting. And that's that 1990 saw a consolidation of the defense industry from about 37 firms to five prime firms. So we ended up with Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Boeing. And I'm just curious how you feel like the consolidation of the defense industry has impacted the Navy.
You know, I still believe that we have enough quality providers of resources, of equipment and operational needs that there's enough competition from those five firms and they're all quality firms and well-run organizations. And I'm not concerned about the consolidation. I think there's an adequate competition today.
That concludes episode 149 of the Sea Control podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Chris Lee, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guests this week, former Secretary of the Navy John Dalton, former First Lady of the Navy Margaret Dalton, our own Executive Vice President Travis Nix, and our new transcriber Danny Luo. If you enjoyed this episode but you haven't yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. If you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.